Imagine writing a piece of software that, instead of executing your code line by line, just decides halfway through to rewrite its own instructions.
Yeah, it's a terrifying thought for any traditional developer.
Right. It completely ignores your syntax, invents a new function you never even asked for, and then confidently charges your company's AWS account like 3 cents to do it.
And the wildest part is that the new function actually works perfectly.
Exactly. Welcome to the deep dive. That is the exhilarating and frankly really messy reality of AI native engineering today.
It's a total paradigm shift. I mean, for 50 years, software engineering has been about absolute control, you know?
Yeah, binary clockwork kind of stuff.
Right. You write a command, the processor executes it. But now we are suddenly dealing with these highly capable probabilistic systems.
Basically, reasoning engines that guess their way forward.
Exactly. It requires an entirely different mental model to build reliable products when the brain of your application isn't deterministic.
Which is exactly what we are going to conquer today. We have a monumental task ahead of us. We are diving into this master-level practice guide for AI engineering.
And it's not just any guide.
No, it's authored by Sam Muthu. He's an enterprise architect with, I think, 25 years of traditional software experience.
Yeah, which is a lifetime in this industry.
Right. And when this whole AI wave hit, he didn't just read a few blog posts. He took an 8-month deliberate sabbatical.
Went totally off the grid?
Yep. Built live products, pushed systems to their breaking points, and distilled everything into this one document.
And what makes this material so invaluable, I mean really invaluable, is the friction it carries. It's not some fluffy thought piece from a lab researcher.
It's battle-tested.
Yeah, it's born from the pain of watching systems crash in production and having to actually figure out how to harden them.
So our mission for this deep dive is explicit. If you are listening to this, maybe you're a developer feeling, you know, overwhelmed by the endless churn of AI frameworks.
Or a product manager trying to figure out why your company's new chatbot is hallucinating weird refund policies.
Right. We are going to go thoroughly through every single point in this architecture so you become a master of these concepts.
From the physics of machine learning to deploying massive multi-agent enterprise systems.
We're stripping away the magic and the hype. But before we get in the weeds, let's set some ground rules.
Please, because I know people hear machine learning physics and panic.
Yeah, do you need a PhD in linear algebra to understand this?
No, not at all. We are going to connect the mechanics of how these systems work to the practical realities of why they matter to you.
Okay, perfect. So let's start right at the bedrock, the engine room.
Right. Before we build an autonomous agent, we have to understand what machine learning actually is.
Sam's document insists that if you can't place LLMs inside the broader ML taxonomy, you're going to make huge architectural mistakes.
Oh, absolutely. He breaks it down into three pillars: supervised, unsupervised, and reinforcement learning.
Let's pull these apart.
Yeah.
Supervised learning seems to be the classic one, right?
Yeah, that's the one most people know.
The one where we basically give the computer the answers up front.
That is the defining characteristic, yeah. In supervised learning, every piece of data you feed the algorithm comes with a human applied label.
So like a massive spreadsheet.
Exactly. Imagine you have 10,000 images of benign skin lesions and 10,000 images of malignant ones.
And a human doctor has actually labeled every single one of them.
Right. Painstakingly. You feed that into the model and it learns the statistical mathematical structure that differentiates the two categories.
So the supervision is just the presence of that known correct answer during the learning phase.
Yes, the ground truth.
But, I mean, the bottleneck there is pretty obvious. You need a human to sit there and label 20,000 photos.
It is incredibly expensive and really, really slow.
Which leads to the second pillar, unsupervised learning.
Right, where you just throw raw data at the model without any labels at all.
Just dump it in. So what is the model supposed to do with that?
You ask the algorithm to find the underlying structure. So say you dump a massive database of 1 million customer purchase histories into an unsupervised clustering algorithm.
You don't tell it what to look for?
Nope. You just say group these, and it might analyze those high-dimensional relationships and discover something weird.
Like what?
Like, it finds out that customers who buy organic baby food on Tuesdays also overwhelmingly buy premium windshield wiper fluid.
Wow. Okay. So it finds latent patterns that a human wouldn't even know to look for.
Exactly. Simply by measuring the mathematical distances between data points.
That brings us to the third pillar, reinforcement learning, which to me always sounds like training a dog.
That is a highly accurate analogy, actually.
So there's no labeled spreadsheet.
No. there's an agent, an environment, and a system of rewards and punishment.
Like giving the dog a treat when it sits.
Right. The algorithm takes an action, observes the result, and receives a numerical reward. Think about DeepMind's AlphaGo.
Oh, the one that played the board game Go.
Yeah. They didn't just teach it historical human matches. They had it play millions of games against itself.
And when it won, it got a reward.
Yes. The mathematical weights associated with the moves it made were strengthened. When it lost, they were penalized.
So it just explored the environment through pure trial and error.
Optimizing for the maximum possible reward over time.
Okay, so why does someone building a modern AI app, like a chat wrapper, need to care about these three distinct pillars?
Because a modern large language model, an LLM like Claude or GPT-4, is actually a Frankenstein's monster of all three.
Oh, really? It uses all of them?
Yeah. Its creation relies on different phases that utilize unsupervised, supervised, and reinforcement learning.
So if you don't grasp how they layer on top of each other, you won't understand the model's behavior.
Exactly.
That sets us up perfectly for the biggest conceptual divide in the entire field. The document points out that confusing these next two phases is a massive red flag in any engineering interview.
Oh, yeah. Training versus inference.
Let's really break this down. Mixing these up is, what, like confusing the construction of a factory with driving a car?
That's a great way to put it. They're entirely different domains of physics and economics.
The way I conceptualize it is that training is the act of writing and publishing a massive, comprehensive encyclopedia.
Right. It takes months, armies of experts, and tens of millions of dollars.
But inference is just paying a librarian a penny to look up a specific page in that encyclopedia when a customer asks a question.
Yes. And building on that analogy, the writing of the encyclopedia involves intensely heavy mathematics.
What's actually happening to the numbers during training?
The model takes in data, makes a guess, and then uses an algorithm called backpropagation to adjust its internal numbers, its weights.
Based on how wrong the guess was.
Exactly. It's constantly calculating what we call a loss function.
I want to stop on loss function because Sam mentions it specifically. In plain English, a loss function is just a mathematical measurement of wrongness, right?
Precisely. It quantifies the gap between the model's prediction and the actual correct answer.
So the goal is to get that wrongness to zero.
Right. The goal of training is to minimize that loss function using a technique called gradient descent.
Gradient descent. How should we visualize that?
Imagine you are standing on a rugged, mountainous landscape, blindfolded.
Okay, blindfolded on a mountain.
And you want to get to the very bottom of the lowest valley because that valley represents zero loss, perfect accuracy.
But you can't see the valley.
Right. So gradient descent is the mathematical process of feeling the slope of the ground with your foot and taking one step down.
And then you feel the slope again and take another step.
You do this billions of times across thousands of GPUs, slowly adjusting the model's weights until it reaches the bottom of the valley.
And the cost of that blindfolded hike is just astronomical.
Oh, yeah.
Sam's document notes that for frontier models, we're talking about training runs that last for months.
And cost between $50 million and well over $100 million just in electricity and compute.
That is insane.
But that is a sunk cost. It happens once. Inference, on the other hand.
That's the moment a user types a prompt into your application and hits enter.
Right. That is where the rubber meets the road for developers. Inference uses that already trained static model to generate a prediction.
So it doesn't need to do any of that backpropagation.
None at all. It requires zero updating of weights. The model's brain is frozen.
Which means it's exponentially faster and cheaper.
Fractions of a cent per request. When a software engineer says they are building an AI application, they are almost never training a model.
They're just orchestrating inference.
Figuring out the most efficient, cost-effective way to ask that librarian to look things up.
Well, let's look at the structure of that brain we're querying during inference. The document talks about parameters and scaling laws.
Right.
We hear these numbers thrown around constantly in the news, like a 7 billion parameter model, a 70 billion parameter model. What exactly is a parameter?
Think of a parameter as a single synaptic connection in a digital brain.
Okay, so it's a connection.
A neural network is a massive web of nodes, and the connections between those nodes have specific numbers assigned to them, weights and biases.
And the total count of those adjustable numbers is the parameter count.
Exactly. So a 7 billion parameter model, which we now consider small and capable of running locally on a high-end laptop.
It still sounds huge.
It does, but it just means it has 7 billion distinct knobs that were turned and tuned during that gradient descent process.
And the scaling laws simply state that if you add more data and turn more knobs, the model just gets smarter.
It is one of the most reliable mathematical phenomena in modern science. OpenAI and DeepMind prove that performance scales predictably with compute, data set size, and parameter count.
So jumping from 7 billion to 70 billion is a massive leap.
A huge leap in reasoning capabilities. And when you cross into the 400 billion parameter range, you are in frontier territory.
Like GPT-4 or Claude 3.5 Opus.
Exactly. These models are so massive, they have to be distributed across clusters of chips just to run a single inference request.
But no matter how massive they get, Sam's document hits us with a sobering reality check. It asks, what is an LLM, really?
And the answer isn't a thinking machine.
Right. The answer is a neural network trained to predict the next token based on a sequence of previous tokens.
It really strips away all the anthropomorphism.
So when an LLM writes a beautiful poem or solves a complex Python bug, it's not actually thinking about the solution.
No, it is simply calculating the statistical probability of the next piece of text, given the text that came before it.
It's just an autocomplete engine on steroids.
Basically.
But how did it get so good at autocomplete that it mimics logic? The document points to a specific architectural breakthrough, the transformer.
Yeah, the entire generative AI boom traces back to a 2017 paper published by Google researchers called Attention is All You Need.
What were we using before transformers?
Older neural networks processed text sequentially. They read left to right, word by word.
Like a human reads.
Right. But by the time an older model reached the end of a long paragraph, its mathematical representation of the first sentence had degraded.
So it quite literally forgot the beginning of the context.
It had the memory of a goldfish.
So what did the transformer do differently to fix that?
It introduced the self-attention mechanism. Instead of reading sequentially, a transformer looks at every single word in the context window simultaneously.
At the exact same time.
Yes. And more importantly, it dynamically calculates how much attention each word should pay to every other word.
I need a concrete example of that. How does attention change the meaning of a word?
Consider the sentence, the bank of the river was muddy. If you process that sequentially, the word bank usually means a financial institution.
Here.
But self-attention allows the model to look forward and backward instantly. It sees the word river and mathematically heavily weights the connection between river and bank.
Ah, I see.
That mathematical weight alters the model's internal representation of the word bank, shifting it from a financial concept to an ecological one.
It contextually disambiguates every word based on the entire sequence.
Exactly. That mechanism is what allows models to maintain coherent reasoning over pages of text.
Okay, we need to clarify a term we've been using casually because Sam emphasizes it heavily. We keep saying the model processes words.
Right, which is technically wrong.
The document corrects this. LLMs do not process words. They process tokens.
This is a vital distinction for any engineer managing costs. A token is a subword unit.
Like parts of a word.
Yeah. The text you type into a prompt gets passed through a tokenizer, which chops it up into these statistical chunks before the neural network ever even sees it.
The rule of thumb in the document is that one token is roughly 4 characters of English, or about 0.75 words.
Right.
So if I have a 750-word document, I'm going to be billed for about 1,000 tokens. Why does the exact character count matter so much?
Because tokens are the fundamental currency of AI economics. Every API provider charges you by the token.
So understanding tokens is understanding your budget.
Exactly. And the computational limit of the model is measured in tokens. If you don't understand how your data tokenizes, your cost projections will be entirely wrong.
And the document points out a major systemic flaw here. Tokenizers are highly biased toward English.
Oh, significantly biased.
Wait, really? How does that work?
English is highly compressed in most tokenizers because the training data was overwhelmingly English. So the word apple is just one token.
Okay.
But if you pass text in Japanese, Korean, or even complex European languages, the tokenizer might chop a single word into 3, 4, or 5 separate tokens.
So a company building a Japanese application is paying literally 3 times as much in API costs as a company building an English application for the exact same semantic meaning.
Yes. And their application will run slower because it takes the model longer to generate 3 tokens than 1.
Wow. Token economics literally govern the viability of the product.
Absolutely.
This brings us to where those tokens live, the context window.
The model's short-term memory.
Right. It is the maximum number of tokens it can hold in its attention at one time, including your prompt and its generated response.
Then those windows have exploded recently.
Yeah, we are talking 128,000 tokens for GPT-4o, 200,000 for Claude, and up to 2 million tokens for Gemini 1.5 Pro.
To put 2 million tokens in perspective, that is roughly the equivalent of uploading the entire Harry Potter series into a single prompt.
The whole series.
Yes, and then hitting enter and asking a question about a minor character in book 3.
Okay, so here is my pushback. If I have a 2 million token context window, which is essentially limitless for a normal business application.
Right.
Why am I bothering with all the complex data retrieval pipelines we're going to talk about later? Why wouldn't I just write a script that dumps my entire company's SQL database and every HR PDF into the prompt for every single user query?
Because the model can hold it, right?
Exactly. Why not just stuff it all in there?
You've hit on a very common early stage architectural trap. Just because you can stuff the context window doesn't mean you should. There are three brutal realities that make context stuffing a terrible idea. First is cost.
Right. Paying by the token.
If you send 1 million tokens to the API for every single user question, you will obliterate your IT budget in a week. You pay for every token sent every time.
It's like paying to print the entire encyclopedia every time someone asks a single question.
The second reality is latency. Processing massive contexts takes time. The self-attention mechanism we discussed has quadratic complexity.
Meaning?
If you double the tokens, the computational work roughly quadruples. A massive prompt will result in a user staring at a loading spinner for 30 seconds.
Which is UX suicide. No one waits 30 seconds.
Exactly. And the third reality, degradation of intelligence.
It gets dumber if you give it more info.
Researchers have rigorously documented a phenomenon called lost in the middle.
Okay, what is that?
If you put a crucial fact at the very beginning of a massive prompt, the model finds it. If you put it at the very end, it finds it.
But in the middle.
If you bury that fact in the middle of a 200,000 token prompt, the attention mechanism often flattens out and the model simply ignores it. It glosses over the middle.
It literally loses focus.
Yes. So relying on massive context windows as a crutch for poor data architecture is a recipe for expensive, slow, and unreliable applications.
Okay. Before we close out the mechanics of the engine room, let's talk about the steering wheel. How do we control the output generation?
The sampling parameters.
Right. The document outlines three. Temperature, top P, and top K. I know temperature is the main dial. How does it actually work?
Temperature controls the determinism of the model.
Determinism meaning how predictable it is.
Yes. When the model calculates the next token, it generates a probability distribution. It might say there's an 80% chance the next word is apple, a 15% chance it's orange, and a 5% chance it's shoe.
A 5% chance for a shoe.
Right. If you set the temperature to exactly 0.0, the model becomes completely deterministic. It will mathematically always pick the 80% option.
We'll always pick apple.
Yes. If you send the exact same prompt 10 times, you will get the exact same output 10 times.
Which is exactly what I want if I'm asking it to write a SQL query or extract data into JSON. I don't want a creative database query.
Precisely. For analytical tasks, keep temperature low between 0.0 and 0.2.
But if you want the model to brainstorm marketing copy,
then you turn the temperature up to 0.7 or even 1.0.
And what does that do mathematically?
It mathematically flattens that probability distribution curve. It squishes the 80% down and boosts the 5% up.
So suddenly the model is much more likely to pick the less obvious token.
It starts choosing orange or shoe. This creates variation in what humans perceive as creativity.
Okay, and what about top key and top K? Are they just doing the same thing?
They are complementary mechanisms that prune the distribution before temperature is applied. Top K is a hard cutoff.
Like a hard limit on options.
Yes. If you set top K to 50, the model sorts all possible next tokens by probability and literally throws away everything after the 50th option.
So it prevents the model from ever choosing a wildly irrelevant token, even at a high temperature.
Like putting guardrails on the brainstorming session, yeah.
Got it. And top P.
Top P, also known as nucleus sampling, is a dynamic cutoff. If you set top P to 0.9, the model adds up the probabilities of the top tokens until they equal 90%.
Oh, so if the top three tokens equal 90%, it only considers those three.
Exactly. But if it takes the top 20 tokens to reach 90%, it considers 20. It dynamically adjusts the pool of options based on how confident the model is.
That is fascinating. So synthesizing all of this, we have this phenomenal mechanism, a neural network tuned via gradient descent, processing tokens through self-attention, bounded by a context window with dials to adjust its statistical creativity.
But here is the critical pivot in Sam's document.
Okay, lay it on me.
If you take a model straight out of that incredibly expensive training process we just described, what we call the pre-training phase,
yeah,
it is actually completely useless as an assistant.
Yes. This blew my mind when I read it. A raw base model doesn't actually know how to chat.
Not at all.
If I ask a raw, pre-trained base model, what is the capital of France? It won't just answer Paris.
It might reply, what is the capital of Germany? What is the capital of Spain?
Why does it do that?
Because it is fundamentally just an alien intelligence optimized for continuing text. It has read millions of web pages. It assumes that a question about a capital city is probably the start of a trivia list, so it just adds more trivia questions.
It has no conceptual framework for, I am an assistant, and this human wants an answer.
None. It's just a pure pattern continuation engine.
So to make it act like ChatGPT or Claude,
yeah,
to make it polite, helpful, and formatted, it has to undergo an entirely separate lifecycle phase.
Yes, called post-training. This is how we transform autocomplete into an agent.
Let's dive deep into this post-training phase because Sam lists several distinct methodologies, starting with SFT, supervised fine-tuning.
Right. SFT is the first step in civilizing the base model. AI labs hire armies of human experts, often PhDs, to write thousands of high-quality conversational interactions.
Like writing out scripts.
Exactly. A human writes a prompt like, explain quantum computing to a five-year-old, and then painstakingly writes the ideal, perfect response.
So we are back to the supervised learning pillar we discussed earlier, labeled data.
You've got it. You train the base model on these thousands of perfect pairs, the model begins to learn the format of interaction.
It learns that when text looks like a question, the correct continuation is an informative response.
It learns the conversational template.
But SFT alone clearly isn't enough because it leads to the next step, which sounds like an absolute logistical nightmare. RLHF, reinforcement learning from human feedback.
Yeah, SFT is limited because you can only write so many perfect examples. To get truly nuanced aligned behavior, you need RLHF. This is the secret sauce that made ChatGPT a global phenomenon.
Why? What does RLHF fix?
Well, after SFT, the model is okay, but it might be overly verbose or slightly rude or confident when it shouldn't be.
Tone issues.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you fix a nuanced problem like tone?
You have the model generate 3 or 4 different answers to the exact same prompt. Then a human rater sits down and ranks them. Answer A is best, answer C is okay, answer B is hallucinated.
And you do this ranking millions of times.
You do it enough times to train a completely separate secondary AI model.
Wait, a second AI?
This is the brilliant part. The secondary AI is called a reward model. Its only job is to look at text and predict how highly a human would rank it.
Oh, wow.
Once you have a highly accurate reward model, you pit the main model against it using reinforcement learning. The main model generates answers, the reward model scores them, and the main model adjusts its weights to maximize the score.
You have automated the human feedback loop at scale.
Exactly.
But the document points out that the industry is rapidly shifting away from RLHF towards something called DPO, direct preference optimization. Why the shift?
Because RLHF is incredibly unstable and complex. Training a separate reward model, keeping it aligned, and running a reinforcement learning loop requires a massive engineering team.
And DPO is easier.
DPO is a massive mathematical simplification.
How so?
DPO skips the middleman. You bypass the reward model entirely. You take those pairs of human rankings, the chosen answer and the rejected answer, and you feed them directly into the main model.
And what does the model do with them?
Using a specific mathematical formula, the model directly updates its own internal weights to increase the probability of the chosen style and decrease the probability of the rejected style.
So is this much more computationally efficient?
Vastly more efficient and often produces better results. It's like showing a dog a treat when it does a trick instead of hiring a dog trainer to write a manual about tricks and then testing the dog against the manual.
That's a great way to put it. And Anthropic uses an even more fascinating variant called constitutional AI, right?
Yes. Instead of humans ranking the answers, they give the model a literal text constitution, a set of principles like choose the response that is least harmful and most truthful.
So the model generates answers, critiques its own answers against the constitution, and revises them.
It self-aligns.
And if you step back and look at SFT, RLHF, DPO, and constitutional AI, the overarching theme here is alignment.
Post-training is the brutal, intensive process of taking an alien statistical pattern matcher and aligning its outputs with polite, safe human intent.
Okay, so OpenAI or Anthropic does all this incredibly heavy lifting. They hand us this beautifully aligned, highly capable model via an API.
Yep.
But now we as enterprise developers face a massive problem. The model is smart, but it knows absolutely nothing about our specific business.
Nothing at all.
It doesn't know my company's refund policy. It doesn't know our legacy database schema. It doesn't know our HR manual.
And this leads to the most common fundamental architectural debate in modern AI engineering. How do we customize the model?
Right. Sam's document breaks this down into fine-tuning versus prompting versus RAG.
Let's start with the immediate instinct every traditional software engineer has. Fine-tuning.
I want the AI to know my company's HR manual, so I should just fine-tune the model on the HR manual, right?
The document is uncompromising on this. No, it is a catastrophic misunderstanding of what a neural network is.
Why do engineers instinctively go there?
Because they treat an LLM like a SQL database. They think fine-tuning is analogous to insert into knowledge base. It is not.
But why doesn't it work? If I train it on the text, shouldn't it memorize the facts?
Because the model stores patterns, not exact records. If you fine-tune a model on your HR manual, it will absorb the vibe of the manual.
Vibes.
It will learn the vocabulary and the tone. But when a user asks, how many PTO days do I get after 5 years? The model might hallucinate a blend of your policy, a policy it read on Reddit during its pre-training, and a policy from a competitor.
Because it can't distinguish where its weights came from.
Exactly. It cannot reliably distinguish the origin of its statistical weights. Furthermore, if your HR policy changes next month, you cannot delete a fact.
Oh, right. You'd have to run a costly fine-tuning job all over again to try and overwrite the weights.
Which is a nightmare.
That makes perfect sense. Fine-tuning is adjusting the cognitive pathways, not storing files in a cabinet. So what is the rule of thumb? When do you actually use fine-tuning?
The golden rule in Sam's architecture is pristine. Use RAG for new knowledge. Use fine-tuning for new skills or behaviors.
I love that distinction, knowledge versus skills. So if I want the model to consistently output its answers in a highly proprietary, deeply nested JSON format that my legacy backend requires,
then you fine-tune it. You are teaching it a behavior. You teach it the skill of formatting.
But if you wanted to know current stock prices or the contents of your HR manual,
you use RAG retrieval augmented generation,
which means we need to understand RAG deeply. We've entered section 3. The AI toolkit.
Right. To make RAG work, the AI needs to be able to read and retrieve our private data.
But as the document points out, an AI doesn't search for text by hitting Control F and looking for string matches.
No, it uses something profoundly different. It uses embeddings.
This is arguably one of the most beautiful concepts in modern computer science. We established earlier that LLMs process tokens. But how do they calculate the meaning of those tokens?
They map them into a high-dimensional vector space.
The document defines an embedding as a dense vector representation of text in high-dimensional space. We need to make this intensely tangible for you listening. What does a high-dimensional space actually mean?
Let's build the mental model. Imagine a standard 3D graph you learned in high school geometry, an X, Y, and Z axis.
Sure.
You can plot a coordinate anywhere in that 3D space. Now, instead of three dimensions, imagine a mathematical graph with 3,072 dimensions.
3,000 dimensions.
We cannot visualize it, obviously, but the math functions exactly the same way. An embedding model takes a chunk of text, processes it, and assigns it a specific coordinate in that 3,000-dimensional space.
And the magic is entirely about where it places those coordinates.
Precisely. The model places text with similar semantic meanings close to each other. The geometry reflects the concept.
The classic example is the king and queen math, right?
Yes. It is the perfect illustration of semantic math. If you take the 3,000-dimensional coordinate vector for the word king, subtract the vector for the word man, and add the vector for the word woman,
you end up a queen.
The resulting coordinate drops you almost exactly onto the vector for the word queen. The AI isn't reading letters. It is calculating the geometric relationships of human concepts.
So if we extrapolate that to sentences, the cat sat on the mat and the feline rested on the rug, those two sentences share almost zero common letters.
Right. A traditional keyword search would say they have nothing in common.
But an embedding model plots them.
And because they mean the exact same thing, their coordinates in that 3,000-dimensional space will be right next to each other. The geometric distance between them is tiny.
That is mind-blowing. semantic similarity literally becomes physical geometric proximity. So if I'm building a RAG system, I take my company's entire repository of HR manuals, technical docs, and wiki pages, and I run them through an embedding model. I turn millions of paragraphs into millions of 3,000-dimensional coordinates.
You do.
But where on earth do I store them? A traditional PostgreSQL database isn't built to do 3,000-dimensional geometry at scale.
Which is why an entirely new piece of infrastructure was invented, the vector database.
Platforms like Pinecone, Weaviate, Milva.
Extensions like pgvector, yeah. These are databases engineered from the ground up to store embeddings and, crucially, to perform similarity searches on those embeddings at lightning speed.
Let's talk about that search speed, because Sam highlights a specific algorithmic hurdle here. ANN, or approximate nearest neighbor search. Why approximate? If a user asks a question, we embed the question into a vector, and we want to find the closest vector in our database. Why not find the exact nearest neighbor?
Because of a harsh reality of computer science, ON complexity.
Meaning it scales terribly.
If your vector database has 100 million company documents and you want the exact nearest neighbor, you have to run a complex geometric distance calculation between your user's question vector and every single one of those 100 million vectors.
Every single query.
Yes. The compute cost would melt your servers. The latency would be measured in minutes.
It fundamentally doesn't scale.
So vector databases use approximate nearest neighbor algorithms. The industry standard right now is HNSW Hierarchical Navigable Small World.
How does HNSW cheat the math to make it fast?
Think of it like navigating a map. If you want to drive from a house in New York to a specific house in Los Angeles, you don't check every single local road in the country.
No, that would take forever.
You use a hierarchy. You get on the interstate highway system, which takes you massive distances across the country quickly. Then you exit onto state routes and finally down to the local neighborhood roads.
So it's creating layers.
Right. HNSW builds a multi-layered graph of your vectors. When a search happens, it drops into the top, highly connected highway layer to quickly jump across the vector space to the right general neighborhood, and then drops down to the denser local layers to find the closest vectors.
Wait, so if I skip the local roads early on, couldn't I miss the absolute perfect match?
Yes. You trade a tiny, mathematically imperceptible fraction of accuracy for an absolute massive speed-up.
Yeah.
You get results in milliseconds instead of minutes.
Worth the trade-off. Okay, so now we have the physical infrastructure of ARA. User asks the question. You embed the question. HNSW finds the nearest semantic vectors in the database.
You grab the human-readable text associated with those vectors, shove it into the LLM's context window, and tell the LLM, answer the user's question using only this provided text.
On paper, that sounds incredibly simple. I feel like I could build our demo in an afternoon.
Well, building a demo is trivial, but Sam's document is a masterclass in production engineering, and it immediately throws cold water on that optimism.
Yeah, he outlines the three hard problems of RAG, because making this work reliably at an enterprise level is brutally difficult.
Let's tackle problem one, chunking. When you upload your company's documents, you can't embed an entire 100-page PDF as a single vector.
Why not?
Because the embedding becomes a muddy, diluted average of 100 different topics. It loses all specificity.
You have to break the document down into smaller chunks before embedding.
Exactly. But if you chunk it too small, say one sentence per chunk, you lose the surrounding context. A sentence that just says, "It should be pressed firmly," is useless if the previous chunk contained the noun it's referring to.
So how do you split it? The document lists strategies. Fixed size chunking, which is naive, just chopping the text every 500 tokens regardless of where the sentence ends.
Which often slices a crucial thought right in half.
Then there is recursive character splitting, which is smarter. It tries to break on double line breaks, then single line breaks, then spaces, trying to keep paragraphs whole.
And then there are highly advanced methods like semantic chunking, where you actually use a smaller AI model to read the text and dynamically slice it whenever it detects a shift in topic.
Oh, it sounds expensive.
It is. Or document-aware chunking, which uses parsers to ensure that a block of Python code or a markdown table is never split in half.
Which one does Sam recommend?
His rule of thumb emphasizes reliability over complexity. Start with recursive character splitting, aiming for chunks around 500 to 1,000 tokens, with a 10% overlap between chunks to preserve context boundaries.
Only move to the expensive stuff if you have proof the simple stuff is failing.
Exactly. Only move to complex semantic chunking if you have quantitative proof that your retrieval is failing due to chunk boundaries.
Which leads directly to problem two, retrieval quality. We just spent 20 minutes praising the magic of vector search and semantic geometry. But the document bluntly states that pure vector search is not enough for production.
No, it's not.
Why does vector search fail?
Because semantic meaning isn't everything. Imagine an engineer searches your company database for a highly specific error code, ERR998-ALPHI.
Okay, a very specific string.
An embedding model looks at that and registers the semantic concept of system error. It might return a document discussing ERR 500 beta because, geometrically, they are very close. They are both about system errors.
But to the engineer, that result is completely useless. They need that exact, specific string match.
Vector search is amazing for concepts, but it can be terrible at exact keywords, acronyms, or serial numbers.
So how do you solve that? You can't just ditch vector search.
You combine them. The enterprise standard is hybrid search. When a user queries the system, you run the dense vector search we discussed, but simultaneously, you run a classic, sparse keyword search.
Typically using an algorithm called BM25, right?
Yes, BM25. It's an evolution of TF-IDF, which basically measures how frequently a specific word appears in a document compared to how rare that word is across the whole database.
So it ensures that highly specific, rare keywords aren't lost.
Right. So you run both searches, you get a list of conceptual matches from the vector database, and a list of exact keyword matches from BM25.
And then you face a new problem.
Yeah.
How do you combine those two lists?
You pass them through a final mechanism called a re-ranker.
Re-ranker.
It's a small, highly specialized AI model. You give it the user's original query and the combined list of retrieved chunks. It rapidly cross-references them and scores exactly how relevant each chunk is to the query.
Reordering the list to ensure the absolute most pertinent information is in the top three slots before it goes to the main LLM.
It's defense in depth. Chunking, vector search, BM25 keyword search, and re-ranking. That is a massive pipeline.
But wait, it gets even crazier. Sam outlines advanced RAG patterns to solve edge case retrieval issues, like query rewriting, where the AI intercepts the user's sloppy, vague question and rewrites it into a highly specific technical query before searching.
A critical pattern, because users are notoriously terrible at asking good questions.
There's self-RAG, where the model actively critiques the documents it retrieves and decides to search again if they aren't good enough.
Also very powerful.
But I want to stop and spend time on this one pattern. It blew my mind. Hide E. Hypothetical document embeddings. Let me make sure I understand this. With Hide E, a user asks a question. Before we search the database, we ask an LLM to hallucinate a completely fake answer to the user's question.
Yes.
And then we embed that fake answer and use it to search the database. How on earth does hallucinating a fake answer improve search accuracy?
I know it sounds entirely counterintuitive. Why introduce hallucination into a system designed for factual retrieval?
Right.
To understand high E, you have to think about the geometry of the vector space again. Think about the physical shape of the text.
Okay, the shape of the text.
Imagine a user types a query. What happens to my stock options if I get fired for cause? That query is phrased as a question. It is short, informal, and anxious. Now think about the actual HR legal document that contains the answer. It doesn't look like that query at all. It might read, "In the event of involuntary termination with cause, unvested equity grants are subject to immediate forfeiture."
Linguistically and structurally, the question and the answer are entirely different.
Therefore, in our 3,000-dimensional vector space, they might not be as close together as we want them to be.
The semantic bridge between the anxious question and the dense legalese is too far.
Exactly. But consider what happens with Heidi. You take the user's question and you tell an LLM, write a hypothetical answer to this.
So the LLM uses its pre-trained knowledge to generate a paragraph.
Right. And it might get the actual facts wrong. It might hallucinate the vesting period, but it will write the answer in the style of an HR legal document. It will use words like termination, equity grants, and forfeiture.
It mimics the vocabulary and the structure.
Yes. So when you embed that hypothetical fake answer, its coordinates in the vector space land right in the middle of the HR legalese neighborhood.
It acts as a structural homing beacon.
It drops you right on top of the actual factual document you need. You discard the fake text, grab the real document, and pass that to the LLM for the final answer.
That is incredible. HiDE is just a brilliant geometric hack to bridge the linguistic gap between user intent and enterprise data.
It really is.
Okay, so we've retrieved the right data, we have the context. Now we have to compel the LLM to output the answer in a way that our software systems can actually consume. This transitions us to prompting, structured outputs, and tool use.
Let's briefly touch on prompting because Sam really strips away the mysticism here. Early in the AI wave, people treated prompt engineering like dark magic.
Oh yeah. If I tell the AI it is a world-class expert and offer a $20 tip, it writes better code.
Right, the weird psychological tricks. Sam focuses on structural prompting. He outlines three core methods. Zero-shot prompting, which is just asking the question directly with no preamble.
And few-shot prompting, which is highly effective. You provide 2 to 5 concrete examples of the exact input and expected output before asking your actual question.
It primes the model's attention mechanism to lock on to the pattern.
And the third is chain-of-thought prompting, the famous let's think step-by-step. Why does adding that one phrase fundamentally improve an LLM's reasoning?
Because of the physics of how LLMs generate text. We establish they predict the next token, and LLM cannot think silently.
It doesn't have an internal scratch pad where it works out a math problem.
No. Its thinking is the physical act of generating tokens.
Generating the text is the computational process.
Yes. If you ask it a complex logic puzzle and force it to immediately output the answer, it only has one token's worth of computational depth to solve the whole puzzle. It will likely fail.
But if you instruct it to think step by step,
you are forcing it to generate paragraphs of intermediate reasoning tokens.
Uh-huh.
You are literally giving the model computational breathing room. By the time it reaches the final token, the self-attention mechanism has all of that intermediate logic and its context window to rely on, massively increasing the probability of a correct answer.
That makes total sense. But all the prompting tricks in the world don't solve the biggest pain point of integrating AI into enterprise software.
The formatting problem.
Right. If I'm building an application, I cannot have the AI return a friendly conversational paragraph. If my AI agent is supposed to extract data from an invoice and send it to my accounting backend, I need a perfectly formatted JSON object.
And historically, this was an absolute nightmare for developers. It was the text in, text out problem. You would write a massive prompt begging the model, please, I implore you, only return valid JSON. Do not include markdown. Do not include conversational text.
And 99 times out of 100, it would obey. But on the 100th time, the LLM decides to be polite. It outputs, sure, I'd be happy to help. Here is your JSON data. And then outputs the JSON.
And your strict deterministic back-end JSON parser chokes on the word sure, throws the fatal exception, and your entire application crashes.
You cannot build a reliable enterprise system if you're praying the LLM doesn't decide to be chatty.
So what is the solution in Sam's architecture?
Native structured outputs.
Yes. In 2026, the solution is native structured outputs. All the major frontier providers, OpenAI, Anthropic, Google, now support this at the API level.
So you no longer beg the model in the prompt.
You pass a literal, strict schema, like a pedantic model in Python, which defines exact data types and required fields directly into the API request payload.
And how does the API enforce it? How does it stop the model from saying, sure?
It alters the probability distribution at the lowest level of token generation using something called constrained decoding or grammar-based sampling.
Wait, it physically blocks tokens?
Yes. As the model calculates the probability for the very first token, the API infrastructure physically blocks any token that isn't an open curly brace. It reduces the probability of the word sure to literal mathematical zero.
Wow.
As it generates a Boolean field, it forces the token to be either true or false. It mathematically constrains the model's output space so that it is physically impossible for the model to generate a string that violates your schema.
It changes the model from a creative writer into a strict data transformation engine, which is the absolute foundation for the next leap, tool use, also known as function calling.
This is where we cross the Rubicon. Structured outputs guarantee the format. Tool use gives the model hands.
How does tool use work in practice?
In your code, you define a tool, let's say a Python function called getCustomerBalance, customerid. You pass the schema of that tool to the LLM.
Okay.
The user asks the LLM, how much money does customer 889 owe us?
The LLM obviously doesn't know because it doesn't have access to your live database.
Right. But because it knows the tool exists, the LLM stops generating conversational text. Instead, it generates a perfectly structured JSON object that requests to call a Get Customer Balance tool with the argument 889.
And then what?
The API pauses the LLM, your local code receives that JSON request, executes the actual SQL query against your live database, gets the balance, say $500, and feeds that result back into the LLM's context.
Then the LLM resumes generating text and replies to the user, customer 889 currently owes $500.
Yes. The model acts as the reasoning brain, deciding when to use a tool and what arguments to pass, but your traditional secure code handles the actual execution.
But Sam's document highlights a major problem with tool use that plagued the industry until very recently. Fragmentation.
Oh, it was awful.
If I wrote a brilliant tool to query my Jira database for a LangChain project, I couldn't use that same tool in a Crew AI project or plug it into Claude Desktop. Everyone had a proprietary format.
It was exactly like the early days of cell phones, where every single manufacturer had a different proprietary charging cable. It stifled interoperability.
Sam highlights the solution that has become the industry standard, MCP, the Model Context Protocol. He calls MCP the USPC for AI tools.
It is the perfect analogy. Anthropic open-sourced MCP as a universal protocol. It solves the M-by-M integration problem.
Also,
you build an MCP server that connects to your internal Jira database or your secure file system. You write it once. Now, any MCP client, whether that is an open source framework, a custom script, or a commercial enterprise IDE, can securely connect to that server and expose those tools to the LLM.
It decouples the tools from the AI orchestration.
If you are not building your tool sets on MCP in 2026, your architecture is inherently brittle and siloed.
Okay, let's take a breath and look at where we are. We have an LLM that understands semantic geometry, can pull secure data via RAG, is constrained by structured outputs, and has standardized access to live functions via MCP.
It can observe a request, decide to use a tool, wait for the result, and act on it.
We are no longer talking about a chatbot. We have officially entered the realm of agents.
Yes.
Let's define that clearly. The word agent is thrown around constantly as marketing hype. What is an AI agent? Structurally,
the definition in Sam's document is wonderfully concise and demystifying. An agent is simply an LLM placed inside a while loop, equipped with tools, and given an objective.
That's it. Just a while loop.
That's it. It observes its environment, makes a decision to use a tool or generate text, acts on that decision, and then the loop restarts. Everything else, long-term memory, complex planning, subtask delegation, is just infrastructure built around that core while loop.
Sam outlines five specific mental patterns for agents. First, the simple tool-using agent. One, LLM, some tools, loops until the user's task is done.
Second, the multi-agent orchestrator. You have a boss AI that receives a complex goal, breaks it down into subtasks, and dispatches them to highly specialized worker AIs.
Third, event-driven agents. This is crucial for enterprise.
Right. These aren't triggered by a human typing in a chat box. They are triggered by a system webhook, a database commit, or a cron job. An agent that wakes up every midnight, reads the daily logs, and writes an executive summary.
Fourth is the RE hybrid, which aggressively fetches dynamic context before making any decisions. And fifth, the most important for safety, human in the loop.
The agent runs autonomously until it hits a designated high-stakes action, like transferring funds or sending an external email, at which point the loop pauses, pings a human for approval, and only proceeds if authorized.
It's a great taxonomy. Yeah. But the real meat of this section, and honestly, what feels like a guaranteed filter question for any senior engineering interview right now, is the debate over frameworks versus custom builds.
The industry is absolutely flooded with open source agent frameworks right now. It is an ecosystem of massive abstractions.
Sam breaks them all down. LangChain is the behemoth. It has integrations for everything, great for getting a prototype running in a weekend, but notorious for being heavy and obfuscated.
LangGraph is from the same team, but treats agent flows as formal state machines, which gives you much more control over the exact routing of the loop.
LemmaIndex is the undisputed king if your primary focus is complex, document-heavy RAG pipelines. CrewAI is heavily opinionated toward roles. You literally assign personas like senior researcher and copy editor to different agents and let them collaborate.
AutoGen is Microsoft's framework focusing on multi-agent conversations. And Semantic Kernel is Microsoft's play for the deeply entrenched C# and .NET enterprise world.
But Sam's most critical insight here is his willingness to step away from all of them. He explicitly outlines when building a custom zero framework agent architecture is the superior choice.
I want to dig into this because if you look at tech Twitter, everyone seems obsessed with using massive, complex, multi-agent frameworks where five different AIs are chatting with each other in a virtual boardroom.
It looks incredibly cool. Is that not the best approach?
It looks cool in a demo, but Sam is highly skeptical of it as an enterprise default. The reality is that many multi-agent designs are just single-agent problems burdened with unnecessary expensive ceremony.
Too much overhead.
Having AIs chat with each other in natural language to pass data back and forth is slow, token-heavy, and incredibly hard to debug. You are relying on the LLM's conversational whims to maintain the application state.
So why build custom? If I want a simple agent, why not just use LangChain? It has thousands of stars on GitHub.
Three reasons, all rooted in the realities of production engineering. First, abstractions obscure the control flow.
Meaning when things break, it's hard to fix.
Yes. When an error occurs deep inside LangChain, say, a tool fails to parse an argument. Debugging it requires you to understand the intricate, hidden internals of a framework you didn't write. The stack trace is a mile long. If you write the while loop yourself in raw Python, you know exactly where the state broke.
The second reason.
Performance and cost overhead. Frameworks often make hidden LLM calls under the hood to manage memory or format tools, consuming tokens you didn't explicitly authorize. Custom code is lean and transparent.
Third reason.
Enterprise constraints. Production systems require highly specific, unglamorous logic. You need explicit exponential retry logic when an API inevitably rate limits you. You need dynamic model routing if the primary model fails, instantly fall back to a secondary provider.
And the frameworks don't do that.
The off-the-shelf frameworks often don't support these enterprise edge cases cleanly without massive hacky workarounds.
So Sam is arguing that once a senior engineer truly understands the mechanics of the observe, decide, act loop, writing 100 lines of clean, custom Python orchestration is often faster to build and infinitely easier to maintain than fighting against a framework's complex domain-specific language.
Exactly. You earn the right to build custom by understanding why the frameworks exist in the first place and then outgrowing them.
But this transitions us from theory into the harsh, unforgiving reality of enterprise deployment. Building a custom agent that runs in a loop in your local IDE is powerful. But what happens when you deploy that to 10,000 enterprise users?
That's where it gets dangerous.
If an LLM gets confused and decides to infinitely loop, hallucinating API calls it 3 cents a pop, you will bankrupt the company by lunchtime. An agent without guardrails isn't a product, it's a liability.
Which brings us to the most rigorous part of Sam's document: hardening for production cost, guardrails, and evils. Let's start with cost optimization, because naive AI systems bleed money.
The first defense he lists is model routing. You do not use a massive, expensive frontier model like GPT-4o or Claude 3.5 Opus for every single task.
I love the analogy you can apply here. It's like medical triage at a hospital.
Right. You don't call the chief of brain surgery down to the lobby to put a Band-Aid on a scraped knee.
No. You route the simple tasks like classifying the intent of a user's email or summarizing a short error log to a fast, incredibly cheap model like Claude Haiku or GPT-4 Mini.
And you save the brain surgeon, the expensive Opus model, exclusively for complex logical reasoning, intricate code generation, or final review.
Routing based on capability requirements cuts API costs by 50 to 80% immediately. You build a routing layer that analyzes the complexity of the prompt before dispatching it.
Then you layer in prompt compression.
Stripping out redundant instructions or conversational filler from the system prompt, you enforce strict max token limits on the output so a model doesn't generate a 5-page novel when you only needed a summary paragraph.
And he emphasizes semantic caching. This is brilliant.
It's caching, but mapped to the vector space. If 10 different users ask slightly different versions of the same question, how do I reset my password? Where's the password reset button? I forgot my password. You don't want to pay the LLM to generate the same answer 10 times.
So you embed the first query, run the LLM, and cache the answer alongside the vector.
When the next query comes in, you embed it. If its coordinates are extremely close to the cache vector, you bypass the LLM entirely and just return the cached text. Zero inference cost. Zero latency.
Speaking of latency, the document points out that LLM calls take seconds, sometimes tens of seconds. That fundamentally breaks traditional UX design paradigms. You can't just have a user click a button and stare at a frozen screen or a spinning wheel for 20 seconds. They will assume the app is broken.
Which is why streaming tokens to the user interface is non-negotiable in production AI. You must push the tokens to the front end the millisecond they're generated.
It gives the user immediate visual feedback that the system is thinking.
It vastly improves perceived latency, even if the total processing time is the same. Furthermore, you use async processing for anything non-interactive. If an agent needs to research three different competitors, it shouldn't query them sequentially. It should spawn three parallel asynchronous threads, query all three simultaneously, and merge the results.
Okay, let's talk about the scary stuff.
Yeah.
Guardrails. We're giving autonomous systems access to our data and our functions. Sam breaks defense in depth down into three layers: input, output, and behavioral guardrails.
Input guardrails are the bouncers at the front door. They sit between the user and the main LLM.
What are they looking for?
They use smaller, faster classifiers to scan the user's prompt for malicious intent, like prompt injection attacks, attempting to override the system instructions, and they filter out toxic or policy-violating requests before the expensive reasoning model ever sees them.
And output guardrails sit at the back door. They check the generated text before it is returned to the user.
They redact any personally identifiable information the model might have leaked. They validate that the JSON format strictly matches the required schema, and they look for hallucinations.
And this raises one of the most profound points in the entire document. How do you handle hallucinations in production? Sam's answer is a hard truth. You cannot eliminate hallucinations. You can only architect around them.
Yes. He explicitly calls out the naive approach. The anti-pattern is treating hallucinations as a prompt engineering problem, just adding, please do not make things up, P2, to the system prompt in all caps. That does not work at scale.
Because hallucination isn't a bug in the model. It is a fundamental feature of next token prediction.
The model is designed to confidently generate plausible text. It doesn't inherently know truth from fiction. You handle hallucinations architecturally. You ground the model with rigorous RAG. You constrain it with structured outputs.
And most importantly, you use an automated LLM as judge to read the generated output and cross-reference it against the retrieved RAG documents to verify faithfulness before showing it to the user.
But the behavioral guardrails are the ultimate safety net. These are what keep the system from causing catastrophic damage if the logic fails.
These are your circuit breakers. File system sandboxing, ensuring the agent's code execution environment physically cannot access or overwrite critical system directories.
Turn limits hard coding the while loop so it can only iterate a maximum of, say, 15 times before automatically terminating and throwing an error, preventing infinite API loops. Cost limit kill switches that cut API access if spending spikes abnormally.
And the human in the loop gates. If the agent decides to drop a database table or send an email to a client, it must pause and require a cryptographic token or a human click to proceed.
You cannot prompt your way out of bad system design. Without these physical, hard-coded circuit breakers, you are deploying a disaster waiting to happen.
And how do you know if any of this, the routing, the RA, the guardrails, is actually working? This brings us to evaluation frameworks.
Evils are notoriously difficult with LLMs.
Because LLM outputs are stochastic. They are slightly different every time. In traditional software, you write a unit test. Assert output Paris. If the function returns Paris, the test passes. If it returns anything else, the pipeline fails.
But an LLM might say, the capital of France is Paris, or Paris is the capital. Both are correct, but a traditional string matching test will fail them both.
This completely breaks traditional CI/CD pipelines. You have to rebuild your testing methodology. Sam outlines three evaluation layers. First, rule-based checks.
These are your deterministic tests. Is the output valid JSON? Does it contain the required keys? Does it take longer than 5 seconds? These are fast, cheap, and binary.
Second is reference-based checks. This is when you have a data set of known ground truth correct answers. You compare the LLM's output to the ground truth using classic natural language processing metrics.
Like BLEU scores or Rouge scores. LU scores essentially measure the overlapping n-grams, the sequence of words between the generated text and the reference text, or you can use a small embedding model to measure the geometric semantic similarity between the two answers.
But the heavy lifter for modern AI evaluation is the third layer, LLM as judge.
Because only an LLM can parse the nuance of helpfulness or tone. You use a separate, usually highly capable frontier model. You give it a very strict, detailed grading rubric. You pass it the user's question, the context, and the agent's output, and you ask it, grade this response on a scale of 1 to 5 for factual accuracy. Grade it for adherence to tone. Provide reasoning for your scores.
But wait, LLM judges aren't perfect. The document points out they have inherent biases. They suffer from verbosity bias. They automatically assume longer answers are better answers.
They absolutely do. And they prefer answers written in a style similar to their own pre-training data, which is why you cannot blindly trust an LLM judge. You have to periodically calibrate the judge against human graders.
You take a sample of 100 outputs, have senior engineers score them, and compare those scores to the LLM scores to measure its reliability.
And to do any of this evaluation, to debug any of these loops, you need massive observability. You can't just log error 500.
Observability in AI is paramount. You need to log the exact prompt sent, the exact raw response received, the precise token counts, the latency of the request, the tools called, and the intermediate chain of thought reasoning for every single interaction in the chain.
Tools like Langsmith, Helicone, or even a highly customized Postgres schema are essential. If you aren't logging full nested execution traces, you are flying completely blind when an agent fails in production.
Okay. We have covered an immense amount of foundational theory. The physics of the tokens, the geometry of embeddings, the RA retrieval pipelines, the architecture of the agent loops, and the rigorous guardrails required for production. All of this abstract theory has been building to this moment.
We are entering the masterclass.
This is where we look at Sam Muthu's actual proprietary production architecture. This is how a 25-year enterprise architect orchestrates all these pieces into a reliable engine.
This is the synthesis of everything we've discussed, applied to solve a massive real-world engineering problem.
He calls his core architectural pattern the LLM Council architecture. Let's break this down. He doesn't just rely on one massive model.
No, he uses Anthropic's Claude as the primary orchestrator and the high-level architect to make the initial decisions. But then he uses Google's Gemini as a rigorous code reviewer to critique Claude's logic and OpenAI's Codex or similar models as the implementation executors.
Why build a council? Why not just use Claude for everything?
It is a profound insight into the algorithmic nature of these models. Single model architectures possess systematic, inherent blind spots. Every model is constrained by its pre-training data.
Okay, so if Claude writes a bug...
If Claude writes a subtle logical bug because of a specific quirk in its training weights, and you ask Claude to review its own code, it is highly likely to gloss right over that bug. Its internal biases genuinely perceive that flawed pattern as correct.
Right. It's the ultimate form of algorithmic confirmation bias. You can't effectively proofread your own essay.
Exactly. By forcing different model families, Anthropic, Google, OpenAI to interact, he gets automatic, genuinely independent second opinions.
Gemini was trained on different data with different RLHF priorities than Claude.
So its geometric representation of concepts is slightly different. Therefore, it will spot edge cases and logical flaws that Claude is blind to. The LLM Council is a structured, multi-model evaluation framework designed to eliminate systematic hallucination.
And he implemented this council architecture in his own production system, which he calls the AI Factory, specifically a massive autonomous project called WatchAlgo. This system generated over 1,600 highly complex AI-authored solutions for advanced algorithm problems.
And here is the metric that matters. It did this with zero human intervention for over 30 hours of continuous autonomous operation.
That is the holy grail of agentic workflows, a system that can run for a day and a half, hitting errors, debugging itself, and continuing without crashing or spinning out of control.
How is that even possible? He outlines the architecture. He has a single agent loop at the core, handling individual tasks, but a massive multi-agent orchestrator managing the whole system using a thread pool.
So he has multiple independent worker agents running tasks in parallel, maximizing throughput. And he utilized a modular dual registration tool, SDK. What does dual registration mean in this context?
It's an elegant solution to the tool use problem we discussed earlier. Dual registration means the tools are defined twice, but kept strictly separate.
That's for sure.
First, they are defined as an API schema, the precise JSON structure and descriptive text that the LLM needs to see in its prompt to understand how to call the tool. Second, they are defined as the actual secure Python runtime implementation that executes the code on the server.
By keeping the prompting layer completely, cleanly separated from the execution layer, he can update the underlying Python code without breaking the LLM's understanding, and vice versa. It creates modularity.
But the real reason this system ran for 30 hours without a human stepping in to fix things is what he calls report cards. This is his automated evaluation framework realized in code.
The report cards are relentless quality gates. Every single output generated by a worker agent had to pass 12 different rigorous criteria before it was allowed to move forward in the pipeline.
It checked for strict schema compliance. It checked for structural completeness. It used LLM as judge to apply rubric-scored content quality checks. And crucially, it actually executed the generated code in a sandbox and captured the stack trace.
And if an output failed any of those 12 checks?
It didn't just crash. It triggered an autonomous autofix loop. The system would package the failing output, the specific error message from the report card, and the original prompt, and send it back to the LLM console with instructions to debug and regenerate.
And beneath these report cards were the circuit breakers we talked about. The file system sandboxing so an errant agent couldn't delete the project. The hard max turn limits so an agent couldn't get stuck in an infinite debugging loop. Dry run modes to test execution paths without spending tokens.
They weren't just theoretical best practices. They were the load-bearing walls of the AI factory.
This all builds to Sam's ultimate philosophy on the future of software engineering, which he crystallizes into the four productivity tiers. This is his definitive response to the casual claim that, oh, everyone uses AI nowadays.
He breaks it down to show the vast chasm in actual mastery. Tier zero is traditional baseline development. No AI assistance whatsoever. You are writing every character manually.
Tier one is AI autocomplete. This is what most developers are doing today, using tools like GitHub Copilot or cursor tab completion to finish lines of code or boilerplate functions.
It is useful, and it maybe gives you a 2x or 3x productivity boost, but it doesn't change how you build software.
Then we reach tier two, which Sam refers to as vibe coding. And he issues a massive warning. Vibe coding is a trap.
Let's define vibe coding, because we have all been there. It's 2 a.m., you are exhausted, and you just type, build me a React login screen with authentication into Claude.
You copy the giant monolithic block of code it spits out, paste it into your IDE, hit run, and pray it works.
And often, it does work, initially. Sam acknowledges that vibe coding gives you a massive short-term boost, maybe 5x or 10x faster than traditional coding. But it is a catastrophic long-term trap because you skip the architecture phase.
You don't actually know how the authentication works.
Exactly. The quality of an AI's output is strictly mathematically bounded by the quality of the specifications you give it. Vibe coders get messy, fragile spaghetti code because they are relying on the LLM's statistical averages to make critical architectural decisions for them.
3 days later, when a bug appears deep in that generated code, the vibe coder has no mental model of the system to debug it. Their architecture is built on sand.
Which leads us to the pinnacle, tier three, spec-driven AI native development. This is what Sam practices. This is the culmination of everything in the document. He states that tier three isn't a 10x multiplier over traditional dev. It is a 100x multiplier, two full orders of magnitude.
Because in tier three, you completely invert the relationship with the model. You do not use the AI as a code generator first. You use the AI as a senior architectural partner first.
You don't prompt, build me X. You write a detailed architectural document and prompt the AI, challenge my design for X.
Yes. You argue with the LLM council over the specifications. You use the models to brainstorm edge cases, address modularization, design multi-tenancy structures, and explicitly map out failure modes before a single line of execution code is written. You force the AI to help you build an airtight blueprint.
And then this is the part that proves the rigor. He has the AI review its own generated specification in a second pass critique to catch logical gaps. Only after that rigorous multi-model specification is locked in and verified does he unleash the agent orchestration to actually write the code step by step, verified by report cards.
That is what true engineering rigor looks like when applied to probabilistic systems. The gap between vibe coding and tier three is the application of architectural thinking. You cannot copy that from a 5-minute YouTube tutorial. It requires a deep, fundamental understanding of the engine room we started in.
Man, we have covered an unbelievable, monumental amount of ground today. We started with the absolute physics of machine learning. We mapped the brutal economic realities of training versus inference and the mathematical constraints of tokenization and context windows. We navigated the complex shift from pre-trained autocomplete engines to helpful aligned assistance using RLHF and direct preference optimization.
We unpacked the geometry of RA and vector spaces, showing exactly how AI maps human concepts into mathematics to retrieve context. We explored the mechanics of the agent wall loop, the hidden dangers of open source frameworks, and the absolute necessities of production hardening cost routing, defense in depth guardrails, and LLM as judge evaluations.
And we tied it all together with Sam's spec-driven architecture, the 30-hour autonomous watch-all-go run, and the multi-model LLM council. To you, the listener who stuck with us through this entire intense journey, Thank you. I know this was dense. We promise to make you a master of these concepts. And if you have internalized the mechanisms we discussed today, you are miles ahead of the vast majority of the industry.
You truly are. By understanding these underlying mechanics, you strip away the illusion of magic. You replace the marketing hype with rigorous, highly controllable engineering principles. You now possess a mental model of how these systems actually reason, and more importantly, exactly how they fail and how to build architectural defenses against those failures. This isn't theory anymore. This is a toolkit you can apply tomorrow.
As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with a final philosophical thought to mull over, building on Sam's concept of the LLM Council. Sam uses different AIs with different training weights to rigorously review each other's logic to catch systematic blind spots. If the ultimate, most reliable way to get production-grade output is to construct a virtual courtroom of arguing AI models, with one generating code, one critiquing the architecture, and one acting as the final judge grading the report cards.
It fundamentally changes what it means to be a software developer.
Exactly. Are we rapidly moving toward a near future where human engineers simply don't write syntax anymore, where we don't even review the pull requests, but instead our sole job is to act as the final presiding human judge over a courtroom of highly specialized arguing AI agents?
Food for thought as you fire up your IDE and start building. Because at the end of the day, you are no longer writing the encyclopedia line by line. You are architecting the entire library, and you are managing the incredibly capable, slightly unpredictable librarians. Thanks for diving deep with us.